On the docket is Capers versus Commonwealth. Ms. Thames, is it Thames?
Thames.
And Ms. Tyson?
Good morning.
We'll give you both a minute to settle in. Have you both signed in?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Take a minute to get set up and... Ms. Thames, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would ask for 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Samantha Abbott Thames, and I represent Mr. Sterling Capers on his appeal, and I'm from the Richmond Public Defender's Office. Your Honors, this case essentially deals altogether with one question, which is eyewitness testimony, and how the Court addressed that throughout this trial. Here, the Commonwealth's case rose and fell on identity, as well did Mr. Capers' defense. And therefore, the trial court erred in not giving the eyewitness jury instruction as asked for, because that was Mr. Capers' sole defense, and it was supported by the law, as well as more than a scintilla of evidence in this particular case. As this Court is aware, there is a model jury instruction note 2.800, which is what this instruction was based upon.
That instruction also has sort of a caution to it, does it not?
It does, Your Honor. It goes into length because it also acknowledges that this Court and the Supreme Court has not fully taken up the eyewitness jury instructions such as other states have and the federal system has. So it does acknowledge that, but it also acknowledges the fact that Virginia is one of the, has not taken on a line of reason that other states and the federal courts have taken, and also noted that decisions such as Perry v. New Hampshire out of the United States Supreme Court have indicated a direction that the courts are taking in the federal system and the nation overall towards granting these eyewitness jury instructions when identity or eyewitness testimony is a major issue in the case. So yes, Your Honor, there is basically a cautionary note, which was to say that Virginia has not fully adopted this yet. However, Virginia also has not closed the door. In Payne, both this court and the Virginia Supreme Court noted that we are not saying no, never. We're saying not this case. And this case is that case, Your Honor. This case was entirely based upon eyewitness testimony for Mr. Capers. And the jury instruction was supported by the evidence at trial. Moreover, in making this decision, the trial court did essentially weigh the evidence. She, I believe it's on Joint Appendix 206, she was talking about how much evidence was here and whether or not it went towards enough to grant the instruction. And the fact that she's weighing means that there was a scintilla, so that instruction should have been given.
Well, counsel, in the cases from the Supreme Court, Daniels and Payne, don't they suggest that currently the law in Virginia is that the an issue of abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, but it also goes towards the way to give it is also towards the proponent of the instruction, which was Mr. Capers in this
case. Sure, I understand that. But didn't they leave the issue in Virginia with not only the possible adequacy of the current instructions, which were given in this case, but also whether there was an abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, however, the judge did not weigh the other, in her finding, did not weigh the other instructions given. She solely focused on the facts of this case, which is different from Payne, where I believe the trial court there did weigh the other jury instructions. Here, the judge focused solely on what was presented in this case and decided that based off that, the instruction was not warranted.
But at this juncture, don't we look to the entire record to make a determination as to whether there was an abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. And here, the other instructions, while they were given, we're maintaining that they did not go towards Mr. Capers' defense, which is also a distinction that between Payne and this case, as we did raise it as an assignment of error. His sole defense was, it was not me. That was not me. The witnesses are mistaken. So therefore, it was his sole goal, Your Honor, and he should have been entitled to an instruction based off that as well. The other instructions, while they were given, they are essentially, as we would argue, the court's instructions and the Commonwealth instructions. Mr. Capers was entitled to his own instruction as well, much like if he was arguing self-defense.
Well, he's not entitled to that if the other instructions cover it, right?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, but we also maintain on appeal that he should have been given it under the same analysis as self-defense, whereas other instructions could cover it. However, if defendants raise enough evidence to mount a scintilla, they are still granted a self-defense jury instruction. And similarly here, we maintain there was enough evidence here to support, if not the longer, because there also, Your Honors, I will point out, there were three different varieties offered to the court. There was a longer jury instruction, a shorter and shortest jury instruction on eyewitness testimony. The evidence in this case did support granting at least one of those jury instructions. While Virginia has not fully gotten there yet, the law is headed that direction, and we ask the court to consider allowing this case go back for Mr. Gabers to receive the eyewitness jury instruction, which he was entitled to, as it was, in fact, his sole defense in this case. And that was also acknowledged by every party in this case. The Commonwealth acknowledged it, the judge acknowledged it, and obviously Mr. Capers argued it repeatedly. And while the Attorney General maintains that he was not entitled to this because he was able to argue it throughout, the purpose of jury instructions is for the judge to essentially speak to the jury and to inform them of the law. And we maintain that they should have been given this instruction.
Counsel, how do you speak to Payne in reference to special factors and to whether your jury instruction or the one that was submitted for consideration would have been squarely within that Payne consideration?
If Your Honor is referring to the cross-racial aspect
yes.
of that, yes. On this record, there is, in fact, a note. The trial counsel explicitly asked Mr. Kingdom, the gentleman who was at the store that day, and Your Honor, just so for the record, I know this is going to be a weird question, but you are white, correct? And the gentleman who robbed you was black, correct? So there actually was in this record, and it was established that this was cross-racial. So therefore, there was evidence for this court to review as well that since it was cross-racial, this witness instruction should have been given. Your Honors, as well, the trial court should not have permitted Ms. Taylor to testify in this case. She simply did not have sufficient information, personal information, to move forward and to testify. She was not there on that day. She does not actually know Mr. Capers. She simply has seen him in the store a few times, and she testified at trial that the closest she ever gotten to him was when she was testifying at trial. She'd never spoken to him. She did not know him. And she did not have sufficient personal basis of knowledge to be able to testify in this case.
Counsel, is your position... I'm sorry, go ahead. Is your position, though, that if someone sees someone on more than one basis and hasn't spoken to them, that they're mm-hmm. not able to identify that person?
Your Honor, she went farther than just being able to say, like, yes, I've seen him before. She immediately was like, that's Mr. Capers. She went beyond an extra additional step, Your Honor, and that's the hearsay we are objecting to as well, her being able to testify to her prior statements that I told him immediately it was Mr. Capers. We're maintaining that was hearsay, and we're saying that she didn't have enough information in order to make those statements, to jump to that conclusion, especially if the court has been able to review the video. Based off the video itself, it's illogical that she could be able to say, yes, that's Mr. Capers from that video. So
does it matter if the trier of fact has the video in front of them?
Yes, Your Honor, because she's the only witness here. Mr. Kingdom could not say, that was Mr. Capers, I know him, it was him. While he did do a lineup and everything else, she was the only witness to be able to say, yes, that was Mr. Capers. So we do maintain that it was very crucial. It was not harmless error in this case, because she was the only person to be able to point to this video and say, yep, that's him, essentially, Your Honors. So it is important here, even if the jury had this video, because it also had this woman be able to say, like, based off my experience, I know it's Mr. Capers, even though she did not actually have significant personal information to base that upon. So therefore, Your Honors, we maintain that she should not have been permitted to testify in this case. Your Honors, moreover, she did testify to an ultimate issue in this case. While the court has said that identity is not an ultimate issue, we maintain on appeal that it is an ultimate issue of fact. It is an element that needs to be proven in every case, much like jurisdiction. However, in identity, it's something that is actually at issue. Typically, if it's a jurisdictional issue, it's clear where it happened, but identity, it's something that has to be actively proven by the trier of fact, to the trier of fact.
To adopt that position, we'd have to overrule some cases over which we have no jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. However, that is what we maintain on appeal, is that it is an ultimate issue of identity. I'm sorry, an ultimate issue of fact. For her to have testified to it is error in this case. Your Honor, it also, there was not enough evidence and simply to convict Mr. Capers on in this case. Mr. King didn't have enough time to view him. There is much of a the lineup is questionable. I do understand that the AG is arguing that it's better addressed with a motion to suppress. However, the police interrogation, police procedures are open question at trial for the court to consider. And given the totality of the information here, there simply was not sufficient information for this jury to reasonably find that it was, in fact, Mr. Capers who robbed Mr. Kingdom. Clearly, the Commonwealth has established that a robbery did occur, but we maintain that they did not sufficiently prove that it was Mr. Capers who committed that robbery. So therefore, Your Honors, we would maintain that based off of, you know, beginning with Talfaro moving forward, the jury instructions were based in the law. They were supported here by more scintilla of evidence. It was established in the record, though, it was a cross-racial identification. This case does rise and fall on whether or not the Commonwealth was able to prove it was, in fact, Mr. Kingdom in those videos and that store that day. Therefore, he was entitled to receive those jury instructions on that point. And if the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have some time left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Tyson, good morning.
May it please the court. This case is controlled by Payne because criminal agency was Payne's sole defense as well. And I think it's very important, we cited it in our brief, and I don't want to belabor the point, but the Supreme Court in Payne said a court may exercise its discretion and properly exclude an instruction that both correctly states the law and is supported by the evidence when other granted instructions fully and fairly cover the relevant principle of law. The exact same instructions that were given in Payne were given in this case. The credibility instruction from Chapter 2 of the jury instructions, and also a fairly new instruction which told the jury that the Commonwealth bore the burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prove identity.
For counsel, in Payne, wasn't there also the issue about whether there's a preservation of the cross-racial?
That is one thing, yes,
but
you are correct.
But we have that here, where there is clearly some mentioning about that, so you acknowledge that it's present.
It is present in this case. It is in the instruction. The problem in Payne is that cross-racial was not actually in the instruction that was proffered to the court, and it is here. But I think that what's important from the Payne decision overall is when you have the question about abuse of discretion, you look at the other instructions. The Supreme Court in Payne spent a great deal of time discussing the credibility instruction and how it addressed reliability as well. There are other things in the instruction that was proffered here, things that can be argued, things that about which one can be cross-examined. For instance, I'm looking at 287. There's a portion of one of the instructions that says that certainty, one can be certain and can be incorrect. One can be not certain and can be correct. So while these are not legal principles necessarily and principles about which there can be cross-examination and summation to the jury, they don't fit into a required jury instruction. The Supreme Court has decided twice now, in Daniels and in Payne, that this is a matter of the court's discretion. And the court here understood that. In fact, the court said, I have discretion, and this is not the case for giving this instruction. I will point out as well that 2.8 in the jury instructions book is not an instruction. It is a note. It is a discussion, and there are some suggestions for the very reason that Payne and Daniels leaves open the possibility that in the appropriate case, you may have one of these instructions. And here are some considerations. I would also note that...
So the note is basically for attorneys and trial judges.
It is. And maybe you could say, well, every instruction is for that purpose, but this is not a model instruction. I would also point out that the instruction was revised this year, and it is out as of this month, and there are three paragraphs of that note that discuss the Payne decision from the Virginia Supreme Court. I do not think that it is important that the trial judge here did not focus on the fact that the other instructions covered the issues. It was argued to the judge at 201 of the appendix. Defense counsel argued that she didn't think the other instructions did adequately cover the issue of identity. And as I pointed out, that was the defense in the Payne case as well as it is here. The court did not abuse its discretion, and the defendant did not object on the ground that the trial judge was substituting or usurping the jury's place. There was no objection made that you're weighing the evidence and you shouldn't be doing that. Yes, the instructions were proffered. And yes, the court denied those instructions. But to make an argument on appeal that the trial court acted inappropriately or erred in weighing the evidence or usurping the jury, that issue was not preserved. We do argue that any reference to law enforcement's photo array as being inappropriate or pertinent to this case was a matter for a suppression hearing, and there was not a suppression hearing in this case. There were several suppression hearings in Payne. There was no suppression hearing in this case. In response to the reply brief, that our argument is that cross-examination or summation can replace a jury instruction. That is not our argument. Our argument is that the instruction was not required in this case, the court did not abuse its discretion in this case, and then looking at how the information got to the jury in this case is exactly, again, I know we're talking an awful lot about another case, but this is what happened in Payne. And in fact, the Supreme Court, in commenting on more so the cross-examination than the summation, noted that through cross-examination of the victim, Payne successfully laid several facts before the jury in this case that could have led it to conclude the identification was not reliable. The jury's choice not to do so is not attributable to a defect in the court's instructions. That is the situation that we have here. The argument was made to the jury. The cross-examination occurred of the witnesses, and the jury rejected it. The jury did hear testimony from Mr. Kingdom, who did identify Capers as the assailant on page 113 of the appendix. There, on 133 of the appendix, Ms. Taylor identifies him, but Mr. Kingdom did make an in-court identification of Capers. The jury also had the ability to see the surveillance videotape of the actual crime as it occurred. Now, I think it's important that in Perry versus New Hampshire, there was a great discussion about once you get past law enforcement's involvement in an identification case, once we're past the suppression hearing, when you're at trial, there are several safeguards, if you will, and specific instructions are just one of those safeguards. There are several other safeguards. For instance, the fact that the government has the burden to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The rules with regard to evidence, that there must be the probative versus prejudice weighing. The fact that a defendant is entitled to the effective assistance of counsel for cross-examination and summation. There are several safeguards in place, and a jury instruction is just one. As we noted in our brief from the case that's from Washington that did the survey of different states, there are three different ways that states are dealing with this, and discretion for the trial court is one of them, and that's where Virginia is. And based on the facts of this case, our trial court did not abuse discretion in denying that instruction. The instructions that were given adequately, fairly, and fully covered the issue, just as those same instructions did in the Payne case. Now, moving ahead, let me talk about sufficiency of the evidence, if I may. Of course, the standard of review here is whether the decision was plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. And in fact, I think it's important, the Supreme Court noted in McNeil that the trial court has to be, or the fact finder has to be the one to make these determinations because the appellate court does not have the advantage of seeing and observing the witnesses. And in the reply brief, counsel suggests that we improperly have relied on Charity because that was a case that dealt with admissibility rather than the sufficiency of the identification. But I would point out that in both admissibility and reliability, we're looking at the Biggers factors. And the factors from Neal v. Biggers are the opportunity to view the assailant, in which case here it's in a lighted Walgreens, and the victim in this case, Mr. Kingdom, had one sales transaction with the defendant, with his assailant, before the robbery occurred. The degree of attention of the victim. In this case, Mr. Kingdom was filling out a robbery worksheet within 15 minutes. He described the salt and pepper hair. He described his assailant. The accuracy of the prior description. Obviously, the description is there. Victims and witnesses barely get everything right when they're making the description, but this is not a situation where we have great inaccuracy. Level of certainty. The victim in this case saw a photo array shortly after the crime occurred, and he was shown the photographs one at a time. And the initially, I think he sort of stopped at number two. He looked through again, and the defendant in this case was number four. Well, he hadn't seen number four when the first time he saw number two. This wasn't a situation where he was being equivocal. This victim was being very careful. He was looking. He looked more than once. He made his decision, and yes, he said he was 95% sure. Again, I think this is caution and not equivocation. And as noted, he made an in-court identification without any equivocation. The support from Ms. Taylor does help with the sufficiency of the evidence. She certainly was questioned about her ability to identify the defendant in this case. But she saw the surveillance video. She was familiar with the defendant from being in her store, she said, five times within the month prior to the robbery. She also had seen him in the neighborhood. So this is not a situation where the fact finder is without evidence to determine that this defendant is the assailant in the robbery. This is not a situation where the fact finder is plainly wrong in determining that he was the assailant. And I will turn to the evidentiary issue here. I think it's important that our evidence rule 2:701, as we noted in our brief, specifically notes opinion testimony by lay witnesses, sets forth that kind of testimony that can be given by a lay witness, and identity is one of them. And identity is not the ultimate issue. The ultimate issue in a case goes to the elements. The familiar example, of course, is either the detective who says this was distribution, which a detective is not supposed to testify to under Lamira, or the doctor who said this death that I'm investigating, this autopsy I am performing, shows there was a homicide. That's not the situation here. Every day, day in and day out, it's necessary for witnesses and victims to identify the perpetrator, and it's a requirement that someone be able to do it. And it's not an expert who does it. It is the person who is most able to make that identification. The testimony of Ms. Taylor was not hearsay. And in the reply brief, counsel argues that it's not clear in Howell whether the store manager, Mr. Fox, at the, I think it was Bed Bath & Beyond or one of those kinds of stores, whether he actually identified the appellant from the videotape. But I suggest that the opinion does say that he had that testimony. His name is Dustin Fox, and he testified that he watched the store surveillance video shortly after the offense, and the video depicted appellant leaving the store through the entrance door with the vacuum cleaner. I believe that he did identify the appellant from the videotape. He had not seen the crime live. And that, although that's an unpublished opinion, that opinion of this court addresses this exact issue.
So it wasn't real time.
It was not real time. No, ma'am, it was not in Howell. And I think the Williams case, the one with at the ABC store with the little bottles, also was not a real-time vision. There is an evidentiary rule that requires personal knowledge. It's 2:602. But what's important there is that evidence to prove personal knowledge may, but need not, consist of testimony of the witness. We had that testimony of the witness here, and she was cross-examined about whether she had spoken to the defendant and how much contact she had had with him. And thus, the weight of that testimony can be tested in court, and that happened here. I think the Richards case, although because it's so old, uses a little bit more archaic language, is setting that forth, that this is something that goes to the weight of the evidence. And since this was not the ultimate issue, but was one that about which this witness could testify and did testify, it was properly admitted. Her testimony, both in any comments about the videotape and also her identification in court. I would argue that if this court were to find that it was error, that certainly, given all the other evidence from Mr. Kingdom, that it would be harmless. But obviously, it's our position there was no error here at all in admitting that testimony. The court did not abuse its discretion in denying the specific instruction that was proffered, given the other instructions that were given. And the evidence was sufficient to establish that Capers was the assailant in the robbery. If there are no additional questions, we would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the Richmond Circuit Court.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. Ms. Thame, you have a little over 4 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, there were other instructions given in this case. However, the instructions of law given in the case become the law. The instructions given in the case become the law of the case, even if incorrectly given, and jurors are presumed to follow them, which makes them elevate jury instructions beyond simple opening, closing statements and cross-examination. They are different and they are important. And we maintain that since they are different and they are important, they should be distinguished and it should not, a case should not be solely regulated to opening, closing statements and cross-examination. And while the United States Supreme Court did list jury instructions along with a whole host of other protections to caution juries against placing undue weight on eyewitness testimony of questionable reliability, they did still place eyewitness jury instructions on par with essentially having a competent attorney. United States Supreme Court has made it very clear that they also view eyewitness testimony to be a problem and that giving a specific injunction on it is a very valid solution, and we ask the court to consider that in this case as well, simply because the evidence in this case does support giving the instruction. And the judge here did essentially go well beyond what she was supposed to do, and she weighed the evidence. It's merely a scintilla, which is, you know, not truly defined in the law, but it's something, and there's something in this case as well. And, Your Honors, the trial court did rely on facts that are not in evidence in this case when she noted that both witnesses knew Mr. Capers, which was simply not established in the record. And this was preserved, and while trial counsel did not object to her weighing of the evidence, the trial counsel did put forward her arguments as to why she thought that the instructions were supported by the evidence. She laid everything out for the court, and she did note her objection to the court not giving the instructions.
But counsel, so therefore, it's not the objection to the weighing, which you're bringing forth as sort of a central part of your argument. How is the Commonwealth not correct that it's weighed and not before us?
Because the standard is that the issue has to be put before the trial court, and the trial court has a chance to rule on it. And the trial court had trial counsel's arguments. The trial counsel knew.
But not about the weighing. There were other things that were mentioned, but not specifically about the weighing. Would that be fair to say?
No, she did not say, Your Honor, I object to you weighing the evidence.
Then how
but
is
she
that
did
before the trial court? Other factors may be that may be tangentially related, but not the weighing. How is that before the trial court?
Because, Your Honor, it was put forward to the trial court that we do object to you not giving this instruction, and her full arguments were already given, including her analysis of the facts of the case. And while she did not jump up and object to the court entering into this weighing, she did preserve it through taking together her arguments and her ultimate objection. So we maintain it was preserved on appeal. Your Honor, we also maintain that is fully valid to argue weight of the police procedures. While there was no motion to suppress, as in trying to keep out the photo lineup, it is fair to draw the jury's attention to issues within that photo lineup for them to truly analyze what happened there. So we would maintain that it's not simply something you can squarely leave for motion to suppress. It is something that is fair to bring up to a jury to help them look at what the police actually did here and the influence that may weigh, which was included in the jury instruction. And Your Honor, simply altogether, the facts here do support, given the jury instruction. The jury instructions are supported by the law. It's fairly long-standing law in other jurisdictions. I do acknowledge that, you know, we have not fully taken on the instruction and we are a discretion, but here we do maintain the trial court abused her discretion in not granting it because of the facts that we have in this case. And I would simply reiterate that here Ms. Taylor did not have sufficient personal knowledge to be able to testify in this case. I did also acknowledge the Rule 2:602, the Rules of Evidence with personal knowledge. She simply did not have that here. And the other cases cited to you by the Commonwealth are distinctive because in those cases, the person testifying used hearsay as essentially a mathematical tool or to simply testify to what plainly they saw in the video. And here, she didn't just plainly testify to seeing a black gentleman enter a store and commit XYZ act. She added the information of, and that's Mr. Capers. So that was hearsay, and it was improper for the court to admit that testimony. And if there's no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and